Happy Halloween from the Think Christian podcast. You'd think one of our most secular holidays would be a test of our motto, that there's no such thing as secular, but then you wouldn't know us very well. I'm Josh Larson, glad to have you listening. If you've been with us for a year now, you know we did this last Halloween too, offered a Christian defense of horror. That was an exercise in theory and practice. We spent some time laying out a basic argument for a Christian engagement with horror movies. I leaned on the thoughts of Dietrich Bonhoeffer a bit there. Then we went on to talk in detail about The Exorcist and It Follows. We got some good conversation, so as the season turns to spooky subjects once more, we thought, why not do it again? We're going to bring back our guests from that show, Abby Olchesi and Joe George, to consider two other horror flicks, Relic, an Australian release that came out earlier this year, and 1992's Candyman. Now, a spiritual sequel to Candyman was supposed to come out this month. That got delayed due to the pandemic. We thought maybe it would be a good idea to take the time to catch up with the original. I'm really glad I did because there's a lot to digest there, which I'll get into with Joe George in a bit. First, though, quick reminder about our free Pop Psalms ebook. We released it just earlier this month, 12 essays in there considering how our favorite pop, rock, hip-hop, and country songs echo the wisdom literature of the Bible. We dug into a few of those essays on our last episode, talked about Lords, Royals, Bruce Springsteen's Badlands, Outkast's Ms. Jackson, and more. In case you haven't gotten your free copy of Pop Psalms yet, head on over to thinkchristian.net/poppsalms. All right, to the business at hand, A Christian Defense of Horror, Part 2. Abby Olchesi is going to help me make a case for one of the year's best and creepiest movies, Relic. Glad to have Abby Olchesi back. One of the things I like about Abby is that she's been known as an adult to still get into costume for Halloween. Abby, do you have costume plans for this year, or is that one more thing the pandemic is depriving us of?
That's a good question. You know, I haven't really thought much about Halloween costumes this year. I'm thinking a little bit about possibilities for a Halloween party since I have a really big backyard conducive to social distancing.
Okay.
So yeah, if that works out, I might bring it back.
If you're having a party, you've got to get a costume.
I know. Yeah, if I'm having a party of some kind, I might have to put together a costume. My personal favorite weird costume from like my post-college years was like, you remember when Netflix was like briefly turning into two different businesses, Netflix and Quixtar?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So I went as the Netflix Quixtar split for Halloween one year. And I had a t-shirt with Netflix envelopes on one side and the Quixtar logo on the other. And the Quixtar logo was all like ripped up and bloody and stabbed.
Oh, man.
So high concept. I might have to break that out. Yeah. High concept. Yeah. I might break that out again this year.
I think you should and just count the confused faces.
Yeah. It was a pretty niche costume like the year I wore it too. So
I would imagine. That's great. All right. Well, costumes or not, whatever happens in that arena, we will get more horror movies at least this Halloween. And that's always a good thing. This year, we got a brand new one, not something we had to dig in the past, but I don't know if it ever played in theaters at all, Relic, but it certainly made its way to streaming services, and that's where you can find it now. Relic is directed by Australian filmmaker Natalie Erica James. It's actually her feature debut, and it's one, Abby, it's been out for a little bit now, but I know that you just recently caught up with it for this show, so I am super excited to hear if you thought it was time well spent.
Yeah, I did think it was time well spent, and actually, it's interesting that I watched this the same weekend that Kirsten Johnson's film Dick Johnson is Dead released.
Yes.
Because it actually deals with a lot of very similar topics, similar ideas about kind of the loss of a loved one, what it looks like to have parents who are elderly, basically, and deal with that at the end of their lives, and kind of the pain of memory and loss of memory and inherited traits, too. I think all of that plays a role in both of those. So, like, you could even conceivably do them as a double feature.
For sure.
Although I think I would put Dick Johnson at the latter end of that so that you could end on an up note. But
yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, and maybe, you know, we're going to try to avoid spoilers with Relic, but maybe you could describe it possibly as a form of an up note. I don't know. That's one of the interesting things about it. But Dick Johnson is Dead definitely came to mind to me as I was revisiting my thoughts about Relic. The premise here is that a middle-aged woman named Kay, played by Emily Mortimer, She does have a mother who's been struggling with memory issues, about 80-something, I think, named Edna, played by Robin Nevin. Now, Edmund has been living alone in this dilapidated house in rural Australia. Kay's kind of stays in touch with her, but not intensely. And one day, Edna disappears. So the police call Kay. She goes to the house, brings along her own daughter, Sam, played by Bella Heathcote. So three generations of women here in the film. And they sit in the house and for the first day or so just kind of feel helpless. They look for clues, are kind of confused what could have happened to Edna. And then one morning, Edna just returns. She's standing in the kitchen. She doesn't say where she's been. Her memory is even more hazy than before. And so this kind of sounds like it could be the settings for a domestic drama, you know, the concerns of something that a documentary could explore, like Dick Johnson Is Dead. But things get creepy pretty quickly. You know, the house itself starts to show these signs of decay. I think about those stained walls. Strange happenings take place in the dead of night. And then Edna herself, I think, kind of wavers between being a sympathetic figure who we're worried about and a malevolent one who we're scared of. So obviously, as you already suggested, Abby, this is working as a metaphor for dementia. I'm curious if it functioned well on both of those levels for you as sort of a domestic drama, but also this horror film.
It did, actually. And I feel like the way that Natalie Erica James plays with the reality of horror and also later in the film with the kind of more fantastical elements of it, I think is really interesting because it takes a while. It takes a long time, actually, to get to like what we would consider like traditional horror scares. And I mean, it goes really hard in a really interesting way that we can, I mean, if you want to talk about the metaphor of that, we can, although it kind of gets into spoiler territory a little bit. But I remember writing down in my notes that I checked, and I was about halfway through the movie, and I just was like, the only scary things that have been in this so far are things that would happen in real life. Elements like Sam, the Bella Heathcote character, making a decision early on that she feels more sympathetic toward her grandmother, she thinks, than her mother does, and wants to kind of stick around and help her out. And then there's a scene very shortly after that where she has an encounter with her grandmother that's legitimately frightening and gets kind of violent because her grandmother forgets something that she'd told her in a previous scene and has kind of a violent reaction. And all of a sudden, Sam realizes that this woman is not the person that she has known for most of her life, that she's different, and living with her would be a very different scenario than what she'd originally envisioned. And like, that's something that lots of people go through in their lives, that a lot of us have gone through. And there's a real element of horror to that, internal, like personal horror, where it's just a question of identity and safety, and there's a real shock involved with that.
Yeah, there's a psychological horror going on well before we get to the more graphic horror elements that definitely come about. And you're right, as director here, Natalie Erica James shows a real command of the craft of these kind of tropes that if you don't handle them correctly, could become cliched or expected or stereotypes. But here they kind of creep up on you and surprise you anew. It reminded me a little bit of the debut of Ari Aster, Hereditary, just in that, you know, supreme command of the craft that you see on the screen right away. And I think for me, you know, in terms of it being this metaphor, it does depict dementia as this demonic force, you know, something that can't be killed without killing the person. It's possessed. There's a possessive element to this film. There's a haunted house element. And there's that psychological horror element, I think, that you're talking about. We did cover Relic back when it came out on the TC website. J.R. Forresteros actually wrote about it, and he brought up this idea of redemptive suffering. I wanted to read a little bit of what J.R. wrote there. The underlying question that Relic begs is this: how will we face suffering when it comes? Will we flee or engage it? As I watched the film, I couldn't help but think of Paul's letter to the church in Philippi. Paul writes from prison, facing the real possibility he would be executed. He expresses his desire to leave, for him to leave life, to flee to heaven with Jesus. Yet even though to stay meant more suffering for him, he knew this was his deepest desire. So that's J.R. Forresteros. And the idea here is that to stay with someone in their suffering, as modeled by Christ, is to redeem suffering in a way. And so this maybe comes back to that idea of if this has a hopeful ending at all. Do you think that something of that is captured in Relic, Abby? Something about this idea of redeeming suffering?
Oh, yeah. I think there's definitely an entire cycle of that feeling that goes on. When we get into the last quarter of the film, where things really start to take off and take on kind of a horror aspect, I feel like that as a metaphor really comes to the front. There's like a whole sequence that to me sort of represents a form of discovery and also denial, both with Sam and with her mom. I don't want to super spoil what happens in the film, but there's some things that they discover within the house and their reactions to that, if you're following it as an extended metaphor for dementia, I think really reflect how a person might feel if they suddenly realize the fact that genetically they are probably going to wind up having dementia in later years as well. Mm-hmm. And the way that that sequence finally ends, it's like it goes from horror to feeling kind of disconnected and lost to fighting actively against it and finally to kind of reconciling with it and having a sense of comfort that involves like all three of the characters being together in the same space. Mm. And there's something really beautiful about that because it doesn't necessarily feel like you're just kind of giving in and succumbing. It's a recognition of reality and time and how much of it you happen to have left and deciding to live not in fear, but with acceptance.
Yeah. And the stages it takes, as you mentioned, to get to that point and acceptance involving, you know, sometimes sitting in the suffering with this loved one who is going through this. I think in some ways the movie is entirely about Kay's experience and journey here, the Emily Mortimer character, the daughter. The question comes up, you know, how much is she willing to sacrifice in relation to her mother's suffering? How much is she going to deny? You talked about kind of denial and confronting, and then how much will she come to terms with? A shot I keep coming back to in Relic, and it's a minor one, but I think it shows, you know, not only the distinct filmmaking vision, but just what Kay is wrestling with. About midway through, Kay is considering whether her mother would be better off in an institution. So she's touring one. And she's speaking to the woman giving the tour who says, well, we have an opening, something like there's a room with a lovely ocean view. And the scene goes on and they talk about more. We get to the room. And again, the director, Natalie Erica James, just includes one quick shot out the window. And we notice that, okay, if you look between these kind of mundane, sterile buildings out the window, you can see a sliver of water that I suppose is the ocean. And that's kind of a turning point right there, I think, for the Kay character is, am I going to tell myself, oh, I could give my mother this ocean view and she'd be better off? Or am I going to be honest that this isn't really what is best for her? And in a way, I'm doing this to remove her suffering from my own experience. And I think that just, what I like about it is, again, in a movie that's full of wild horror, it's kind of this mundane little moment that people in this situation are experiencing every day when they're discussing of what to do with loved ones, older loved ones. And I just love that Natalie Erica James found the time to squeeze that into a movie that, as I said, could otherwise be kind of wild as a horror film.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's a really interesting shot as well. And I've lived through sort of an example of that. I mean, not too much. My grandmother went into assisted living at the end of her life. And so there's always the question of whether or not they're ready, if this is the right place for them to be, if this is kind of what would make them happy. And in her case, it was. But I understand completely having that sort of interior questioning of, are you doing this for them or are you doing this for you? And yeah, I agree. I feel like from that point on, you see Kay as a much more conflicted. I don't know. That form of conflict for her takes a turn at that point, and you see her as a little bit more inquisitive and curious as to like, what would a more compassionate version of that look like for her and for her mom?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think you're right. It's not that the movie is saying this is the wrong choice for everyone, but it's looking at it in this context and using it as a turning point for Kay. So yeah, what else struck you about Relic just in terms of, you know, as a horror movie or maybe as a horror movie that might have particular interest to Christians who are curious about the genre or might want to get into the genre more?
Well, there's a lot going on. I think artistically, it's really interesting. The way that it delivers scares is often very subtle. And I do like that it feels so rooted in the reality of a certain kind of experience that a lot of people can relate to, that you can recognize both the tragic elements of it as well as sort of the personal horror elements of it. I actually recently did an article for The Pitch about an academic study that had come out recently. The point of the academic study was that horror fans, it turns out, are a little more psychologically prepared for an event like COVID-19 than people who are non-horror fans. And so for that, I talked to the folks who did the study as well as some kind of local horror critics and enthusiasts from the film scene here. And a lot of the conversation that we had was about how horror can be a force for healing. Like if you're going through a specific experience in your life and a horror movie happens to hit you like just at the right moment, that it can be a real experience of catharsis, of like working through a difficult situation and seeing how somebody else deals with it, or recognizing certain themes that apply to your own life as like maybe a cautionary tale of a way not to live, or maybe an emotional sense of like, would it be so bad if I accepted this thing that's happening to me? And I feel like Relic is definitely a movie like that. In fact, it came up in my conversation with some of the folks that I talked to specifically. Yeah, as a movie that can kind of have that healing and cathartic power.
Yeah, I can totally see that. I think that's absolutely true. I think healing is part of that complicated final sequence that we're dancing around. The visual image that you get there is really powerful. And that's probably why neither of us wants to spoil it for someone who hasn't seen Relic yet. We'll definitely link to that article you're talking about, Abby, in the show notes for listeners who want to track that down. And you mentioned Dick Johnson is dead. I am writing a piece about that. It'll be up by the time this episode is out at thinkchristian.net, as well as in a movie that deals with dementia and also healing and restoration, really. It's fascinating in that way. So yeah, really difficult topic. You mentioned your grandmother. I'm having similar experiences with my grandfather. I think this is probably something just about almost everyone is touched by in some way. And it's really interesting right now that we have, as you said, two very different films touching on it from two very different angles, but I think both are rewarding in helping you kind of process this sort of thing in your own life, whether you like horror, whether you like documentaries. So that article will be up at thinkchristian.net, along with J.R. Forasteros' article from a couple of weeks ago, maybe a few months ago now, on Relic. So yeah, maybe any quick Dick Johnson is dead thoughts, Abby, as someone who has seen it while I've got you here?
Yeah, absolutely. I love this movie a lot. And I think it deals with, in a much more warm-hearted kind of a way, a lot of those same things and a lot of those same concepts. But there's also just such a strong element of love and care and servanthood, I think, that runs throughout that movie. It's extremely touching and will resonate with pretty much anybody. Like if you've had a relative go through this, if you've even thought about it being a possibility in your life for like more than 2 seconds, I feel like a lot of the ways that Kirsten Johnson approaches this and the emotions that she expresses while making it feel very close to a lot of people's own personal experiences.
Yeah. If we haven't mentioned it, Kirsten Johnson, the director of Dick Johnson is Dead, is making the film about her father. So yeah, very personal, creative work that is an act of servanthood. I like how you describe that. That seems just right. Well, Abby, thanks for coming on to talk about Relic. Thanks for making this a Halloween tradition with me. We'll have to do it again next year, okay?
Yeah, absolutely. Looking forward to it.
All right, take care.
That was Halsey's Graveyard from last year. Remember that one? Amazing how fast pop songs find their way into the boneyards of pop culture these days, isn't it? The good ones haunt us, though, don't they? Stuck in our heads like specters, clinging to us like shadows, ready to jump out at us when we're going to get a drink of water in the middle of the night. Well, maybe that's just me. Hey, y'all, it's your resident ghoul, John J. Thompson, here inviting you to revisit our updated playlist called A Christian Defense of Horror, either as a mood setter for this Halloween season or just as mood music for what has become our daily reality. I put this list together last year for the corresponding episode of the podcast, which, if you haven't heard, you definitely should revisit. But I have taken that original list, which includes classics by Talking Heads, Echo and the Bunnymen, Susie and the Banshees, Bob Dylan, and Blue Oyster Cult, and a lot of others, and mix them up with new hip tracks by Ruel, Chelsea Wolfe, Shovels and Rope, and a whole lot more. And you'll hear a track from Ministry a little later in this show that, if you grew up in Chicago like I did, was sort of the theme song for Halloween for many of us. But I've added some new ones in this year to the list, and I'm looking for your ideas. What are your favorite spooky tunes? Check out the list and tweet any suggestions to me at John J. Thompson, and I'll strongly consider adding them. Consider this me ringing your doorbell with a musical trick or treat. I don't want your candy. I want your suggestions. Let's collectively build the most creepy, thought-provoking, chill-inducing, horror-themed playlist ever assembled. Then, as you host your own spooky gatherings this year, or sit by yourself in the dark, you can let this be your soundtrack. You know where to find it, right? Just take that third left, just past the old abandoned factory. Take that alley past the junkyard until you see the old shed with the harpoon stuck in the front wall. Come on in when you get here. The door will be open. Once you're inside, walk over to the small black table, pick up the receiver on the old phone, and put it to your ear. Say only the word, playlist, please, and then wait 9 seconds. The music will start. Oh, and whatever you do, don't look under that table.
Joe George is here, which means he must not be too scarred, I'm hoping, from our exorcist debate we had last year on the podcast. Joe, thanks for coming back to talk horror.
You're welcome. I forgive you for your wrong opinions.
Yes, many people have to forgive me on The Exorcist. It's true. That's a disappointment to you, my opinion on The Exorcist, Joe. We've had a lot of disappointments this year that have come with COVID-19, including the delay of anticipated movies like a remake of Candyman or a spiritual sequel of Candyman, I should say, the 1992 film of the same name. So we don't have that now, Joe, but we still have the original. And as we were planning this show, you mentioned that you knew the original Candyman very well. So tell me how you first encountered it, and maybe tell listeners who may be unfamiliar with it what the movie is all about.
Well, first encounter was watching the trailer and commercials back in 1992 when it first came out. I was scared 14-year-old at the time, so I did not watch it in 1992. I did not watch it until 98, late 90s, you know, much later. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was kind of one of those that at that point, I think it had kind of a mixed reception, at least at that point, that people weren't all in on it as much as they are now. Mm-hmm. Like, it was just kind of an okay, kind of gross slasher movie. Tony Todd's great, but that was kind of the big appeal.
Yeah.
And I have to admit, when I first watched it, that's about all I got out of it too. It wasn't until revisiting it really, you know, 10 years ago or so that really I be able to see kind of what it's trying to do mm-hmm. successfully or not. Was sort of the racial stuff. So to give the background of the story, Candyman is about a grad student at University of Illinois named Helen. She's played by Virginia Madsen, and she's doing research on folklore and specifically kind of urban legends. And she sort of stumbles across stories about this figure called the Candyman. These stories are being told in the Cabrini Green housing project in Chicago. And she starts investigating despite various people, including her best friend Bernadette, played by Casey Lemons, telling her not to go in there. And she would continue going into these spaces and talking about how well the Candyman was not real. And this draws the actual Candyman, who is this mystic figure played by Tony Todd. It's this kind of romantic vampire-like figure yeah. with bees in his chest and a claw in his hand. And he haunts her for suggesting that he is not real.
Yeah, and he's quite a figure. It's quite a myth yes. behind him. This is all based on a Clive Barker novel, and that's one of the things. This movie could have gone in 40 different directions. There's so much stuff here, and we'll probably talk about the lanes they choose and the stuff that maybe gets a little confused. But for me, there's a central sort of fear that it's kind of preying upon. And it was interesting, my background with the film, Joe, I definitely remember it coming out because seemed to play on this fear growing up in the suburbs of Chicago that was palpable in those days, because on the local news, every night it seemed like there was some sort of hysterical report of urban violence and crime, and the term Cabrini Green was invoked regularly. And if you were a kid at that age, it was almost like that was the boogie place, you know, that yeah. was, especially if you were in the suburbs. And so I never did end up seeing the movie, the trailers and stuff kind of embedded in my brain as well. But it wasn't until preparing for this show and getting ready for that sequel that's coming out, or the spiritual sequel, that I really sat down to look at it. And it struck me, it is more complicated, I think, than those initial receptions might have suggested. I think it exploits those racialized fears I'm talking about, where Cabrini-Green was this place of, you know, just terrible violence and hopeless people. I think it exploits those, but I think it also interrogates it a little bit. And that's maybe where it gets interesting. It's worth keeping in mind, I mentioned Barker as the novelist. The writer-director here is also white, Bernard Rose. They're both English, interestingly enough. So this is definitely told through a white lens. But watching it, I realized, you know, there's a little bit of what I think you could call a black side eye going on here in some of the little details. And some of the supporting characters, too. I think of Anne Marie McCoy, this working young mother played by Vanessa Williams, who lives in Cabrini-Green and is one of the first actual people that we get to meet, that Virginia Madsen's character, Helen, gets to meet. And those stereotypes start to get broken down. So I feel, you know, fear often arises out of ignorance, right? And in this case, for me, a kid at that age, it was ignorance over Cabrini-Green. And that sensationalism just turned the people living there into these boogeymen and blinded me to the imago Dei that's in them, this image of God that they carry. So I think at its best, Candyman reclaims that when it turns its attention to people like Anne Marie, but it also plays off those fears that I had. I don't know. How do you think the movie did walk that line, Joe, between exploiting racialized fears and interrogating them?
I should make clear, in case people aren't watching this on our YouTube channel where they can see my little picture there, I am also a white dude. So this is also coming from, I mean, this is two white guys with the perspective there. So
good point.
Big asterisks there. But to answer your question, it walked that, it was a wobbly line. Mm. You know, there's definitely times where Anne Marie, I think, is a good one to point out, where the black characters are given full inner life desires and are humanized in a way that puts them beyond monsters. But the movie does also give we are in Helen's perspective the entire time, you know, and I don't know if I should get into this, but something bad happens to Anne Marie directly because of Helen's meddling, and the Candyman shows up and does this horrible thing. We see Anne Marie maybe twice after that in little shots, and we spend a lot of time with Helen's grief, even though what happens to Anne Marie is way worse than what happens to Helen, you know?
Sure.
And there's lots of shots when she first gets to Cabrini-Green and to that one project she goes into where it's just menacing black faces, you know, staring at her. And she does, Casey Lemons is a black actress playing her friend who is going in there with her. And constantly she's telling Helen, you need to leave. We need to leave now. This isn't a good idea. And the movie does good in those parts, kind of suggesting that it recognizes the sort of, in that case, intellectual gentrification that's coming on there, that Helen is co-opting these stories to write her thesis, you know, and even though Bernadette and others are telling her, this isn't for you, she kind of just boldly walks into these spaces and acts like she owns the place, sort of, and that she can take control of them. But at the same time, the monster of the story is a black man who is lusting after a white woman, you know, and so it seems like it's every time it takes a step forward, it does something, a step back, where you're like, oh gosh, you know, we're back in stereotypes.
Yeah, you can't say you're ever fully on board with where you think this movie is going or what its perspective is, because it does have those little hiccups. You mentioned Cassie Lemons, and she's gone on to be a director of things like Eve's Bayou and Harriet. So seeing her here was really interesting. And Bernadette is an interesting character because she's kind of giving Helen that side eye, but she's also somewhat stoking those fears herself because she's the one who carries the taser and the mace, right? When they first go to Cabrini-Green. Even in her, even in the character of Bernadette, you see the movie kind of trying to have it both ways.
Yeah.
And I do think, you know, we do meet a few other residents, a boy named Jake, and in them, we get to recognize that these people are survivors of horror in a way that's real. It's everyday sort of crime, but it's also horror that's imagined as embodied in Candyman. And so they deserve not our dismissal out of fear, but our attention. So when the movie gives that to them, I think it's working, but yet it's not always doing that, is it? And that's where we sort of run into trouble. But I like how you describe how Helen is positioned in the film. And to me, I sort of, maybe it's because I'm watching it in the atmosphere of 2020 and these sorts of themes and ideas are forefront to my mind. But as it became more about Helen and her experience and her story and her, as you said, somewhat sexualized, romanticized relationship with Tony Todd as Candyman, it kind of got less interesting to me. Part of that is because it got so complicated. Like, there were parts of his legend, his origin story, that seemed to directly conflict with other parts. And so I was both confused and a little disinterested as the movie tilted to become more about Helen herself.
Yeah. Candyman is a kind of melange of urban tales that you've heard before. Like, he's got the hook hand, so he's the murderer outside of the couple making out, scratching on the door. You know, you say his name five times in a mirror, so it's got the Bloody Mary thing, you know. I should point out, I just read the Clive Barker story yesterday, so this is fresh in my mind. I'm not a big Clive Barker guy, but Barker talks about how in the original story, which is about more class, it takes place in a council estate in the UK, and everybody in it's white. There's no race in there at all, including Candyman, who is very white. It's more about the stories. It's a meta story. It's like the stories we tell about fear and that sort of thing. And so there is that sort of, on an intentional level, that sort of mix of mythologies that's happening in there. And this is, again, one of those kind of wobbly line places where it is interesting, like you were saying, for white suburban kids, you know. And I grew up directly between Detroit and Chicago, so I was always told, watch out for people stopping in Kalamazoo because they're running drugs, you know. For you and I, who kind of grew up with that, that can be a scary black face, can be just as much of a boogeyman. But that's a totally different order of boogeyman to kind of throw on there. And there's, you just can't help but feel like the British guys don't quite know what they're doing with these sort of things. Like, it's a fun, scary thing to say there's a killer with a hook hand, or, you know, the Bloody Mary. That's fun now, since we're not Catholics and Protestants aren't killing each other. To demonize another human being in that way, that's not the same type of boogeyman. And to kind of throw all these things together, it doesn't quite work. And so there is potential for something to interrogate what we think is scary and why we think it's scary and how that relates to actual human beings that we're demonizing and othering. It doesn't quite get there.
Well, and that's why it's exciting that they are returning to this material, because, and especially who's returning to the material, right? Jordan Peele, I think, has a hand in the screenplay, but the director this time is going to be a black woman, Nia DaCosta, who has previously made a really good film, a smaller film called Little Woods. So yeah, definitely looking forward to this take on the material from what will absolutely be a different perspective, one closer, you have to think, to where this story is set. You mentioned Tony Todd and how he was, as Candyman, kind of the one element everyone seemed to respond to positively, even when the movie first came out. What did you make of his performance? Obviously, he's loaded with a lot of baggage in the way you're just talking about. But to me, somehow he still made it work, maybe because he carried that baggage, but also made this figure more than a symbol or more than a specter, but made him sort of this mesmerizing figure for me.
Yeah. Oh, I think his performance is fantastic. I mean, he's got that great sonorous voice, and the effects that they put on it make it fill the space even more. But on top of that, we keep saying like specter and haunt and that sort of thing, but it's a real bodily performance. Yes. You know, I mean, we see the damage that's been done to his body. And I should back up. We eventually find out that he was the son of an enslaved man who became rich, and he was kind of highly educated and was a great artist, and he fell in love with a white woman in 1890 and was mutilated and killed with bees for it by white supremacists. And he carries that aspect. Like, he's simultaneously romantic and damaged, and in a way that he's a Dracula figure, you know, that sort of, you get that appeal and that intelligence and that allure that he has, while also never shying away from the grossness. You know, we see his bloody stump. We see the violence he does. He pulls open his jacket. And we see the bees coming out of Tony Todd's mouth, which that's a performance. So, no, he's fantastic. And he really is the glue that holds the whole movie together. Even when the ideas kind of bobble around, I just found him magnetic on screen every time I see him.
You mentioned Dracula, and I think he carries a real sense of theatricality going back to like the classic Universal horror pictures, which might seem out of place if you're setting him in, you know, 1990s Chicago. But somehow he has this regal bearing that it's kind of like, I'm in the right place. Everyone else is a little out of place here, but I belong. Yeah. He has that sort of stature and holds the screen. So I'm really glad I finally made the effort to check out Candyman. Anything else you think we should touch on, Joe?
Since the story is a story about fear, you know, as Christians, we're always in a weird spot when we're dealing with fear, since so much of the gospel is fear not. And I think that's important to take in mind here, that as much as the movie is wobbly, it is in a lot of ways about especially white people fearing black people and making other human beings into monsters. And it can be useful to watch these and to interrogate and to recognize the source of those fears. But ultimately, if Christians, we're told to not fear. And in this place, that means not only do we not fear the other people made in God's image, even if that looks slightly different than we are, but also to not fear our sort of generational sins that are baked into this, that you and I as white people are benefiting from a lot of the violence that we see inflicted upon black bodies in this. As Christians, we don't need to fear that. We can live in the redemption and start repenting and doing the work of restoration in relationship to that in the real world. And it can be useful to watch this movie to get those fears out there. But then we've got those next steps, which is doing the works of restorative justice and repenting of the stories that you and I were told as children that made us fear other people.
I think that's how the 92 film does resonate today. And I know what you're saying. You're not saying don't fear it, meaning, you know, don't worry about it. It's like, don't fear confronting it and dealing with it and really wrestling with it and deciding how you should respond in a way that is Christ following towards your past and how you're going to live moving forward. Yeah, it reminds me of what last year when we did this show, it was a little bit more of laying the groundwork too for engaging horror that we all did. And one of the suggestions you made, which I always think of when I'm watching a horror film, is for Christians who are interested in exploring horror is to ask just what you said, what am I afraid of here? And then interrogate that fear. And I think that if you ask those questions and apply them to Candyman, it's going to lead you in exactly the direction you just talked about, which I think, as you said, can be very fruitful. Well, thanks, Joe. You know, I was looking at your profile on our contributors page at thinkchristian.net, reminded how many times you've actually written about horror for us. So you've
covered a few times.
You've done Child's Play, Halloween, Happy Death Day. So if people are interested, if listeners are interested in getting more of your horror thoughts, definitely head to the website and just go look at Joe's profile and you'll find some good stuff there. So thanks for that work, Joe, and have a good Halloween, okay?
All right. Thanks. You too, Josh. Bye.
That's the techno-goth sound of Ministry's Every Day is Halloween. First came out in 1984, and then it was part of a 12-inch singles compilation in 87, which was one of my first cassette tapes that I bought when I really started getting into music. I love it when John J. Thompson's song selections allow me to horrifyingly date myself. Talk about scary. John's been adding songs to that Christian Defense of Horror Spotify playlist that he first compiled for last year's show. You can find it by searching for the Think Christian playlist on Spotify. We figured we'll just keep that list growing, so it's something we can return to and listen to again every year. If you want to help us do that, send some suggestions John's way for new songs on Twitter. You can find him at John J. Thompson. You can also follow our guests there at Abby Olchesi and at J.A. George II. I'm at Larson on Film, and TC, of course, is at Think Christian. Don't forget that our Pop Psalms ebook is available for free at thinkchristian.net/poppsalms. Music nerds, you're really going to enjoy this one. Let us know what you think about the ebook or about this episode or anything else TC related. You can always email us at tcpodcast@thinkchristian.net. The Think Christian Podcast is a production of Reframe Media, a family of programs designed to help you see your whole life reframed by God's gospel story. Visit reframemedia.com for more info. Our audio engineer and post-production supervisor is John Reeder, and Reframe's co-director overseeing content strategy is Robin Baslin. Thank you very much for listening. We'll be back again in a couple of weeks to consider how another aspect of our pop culture fandom connects with our faith.